I'm Sandy Robinson, your host of RevOps Unboxed, and I am so excited today. I'm here with Ann Bao, who is the Fractional RevOps Executive and CRO, CEO and founder of Ignite Consulting. I'm super excited for this conversation, Ann. Thanks for joining me today, and I'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Great. Thanks so much, Sandy. And I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a big fan of you and kind of what you do on LinkedIn and what you post and share. I'm Ann Bao. Like I said, I run Ignite Consulting. It's a solopreneurship, fractional RevOps executive, CRO services to seed-stage startups all the way through to public companies. Prior to this, for 20 plus years, I was an in-house RevOps executive, revenue leader, starting my career in finance, really morphing into operations, analytics, and then revenue operations. And I did that in, you know, large public companies, private companies, startups, both in the US and Africa.
Wow. That is quite a journey. That sounds very, very interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about just the whole concept of being a fractional RevOps executive?
Sure. And so I think, first of all, some of you might have seen that in 2023, you know, RevOps was like the fastest growing head of RevOps career or job title globally. And if I did a search back then, it was like 5,000 people had hits of RevOps in their title and over 2,500 in the US. But this fractional thing kind of has really emerged as like a term. And I've been doing it for the last year and a half. There are people in doing it longer, but I think it's kind of created a surge in the last year and a half or two, even from the time that I launched. What's interesting is there's fractional, there's freelance, there's contractor. Like, what's the difference? There's interim. What's the difference, right? When I think about fractional RevOps, what makes it different than a contract role or than a part-time or an interim role is you're getting kind of, yes, this executive or very experienced leader person to come in for, yes, a fraction of their time, but it's very focused. And the goal of that is, well, this has been somebody who has kind of seen the story multiple times. So you're able to tap into very, very experienced leadership for a fraction of the cost and have them very focused, help you accelerate. That's my definition and how it might be different than just being like a contract RevOps person. And so I think it has to do a lot with the level of experience somebody brings, that experience set across lots of different scenarios. And now they've kind of gone out and they're able to do it across a multitude of different clients at one time.
For sure. And I think sometimes, you know, startups, they really want to bring in RevOps, but trying to bring in a full-time RevOps leader at a Series A or Series B is kind of far-fetched, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, when I was a head of RevOps, I was always recruited in generally Series C, D. And by that point, you have a lot more cash. These companies generally had anywhere from, you know, 150 people to maybe 300 or more. And really, like, the pain of not having a full-time RevOps leader was really hitting them in their areas of both growth and retention. But when you think about it, coming in seed stage, Series A, I mean, if you're a head of RevOps, that could be anything at, you know, sometimes it's a senior manager director level all the way up to a VP. And when you get into kind of this senior director VP level role, you know, your total OTE might be $300,000 to $400,000. That's a lot of cash out the gate, right? And it heavily, as opposed to maybe a sales leader where it's much more maybe like a 50-50 or 60-40, it's a lower percentage of variable. So it's high base salary you're paying, and that's just headcount related costs, not in addition to all the non-headcount related. So it can be very cost prohibitive, which is why so many people wait.
Right. It could be three or four, you know, SDRs or, you know, AE positions rather than, you know, one senior RevOps head. So makes a lot of sense what you're doing. I mean, there's a lot of advantages for sure. So as you're working with all of these different companies, and, you know, I know you're involved in different groups and boards, and you do so many things. What trends are you seeing out there in RevOps that you think people should be focusing on?
Yeah, it's also a great question. I mean, one of the kind of trends and why I think RevOps obviously emerged was, you know, we know this. There was sales ops and there was marketing ops. And then now this new thing called RevOps kind of gained a lot of traction and popularity probably around, I think, like 2019 is when I first started hearing it, like, kind of hit the press. Yeah. So obviously that consolidation, something new that I'm starting to witness being a little bit more common, and I'm excited about it, is, you know, a lot of RevOps that I see is very much like systems or operational functions, but it's becoming much more of a strategic function, much more part of the executive team, which is where I think it should be. It is also not just only reporting into the, it often reports into the CRO. I've reported into like several CROs, 7 or 8, not because I worked at 7 or 8 companies, but because of the tenure of a CRO. but now what I'm starting to see is this emerging trend of RevOps reporting into the CEO or the CFO. I've reported into both. There are strong opinions about reporting into CFOs under RevOps. I think in times it can make a lot of sense. It depends on the CFO leader. So that's one trend. Another trend that I'm seeing is, especially in this age of AI that we're in, which is still like the infancy stage, let's be honest, some RevOps is becoming so critical because typically that team has been the one that's been implementing the go-to-market technology, that's been implementing the workflows and the processes. So now you have executive leaders that are like, how do we actually think about AI embedding into our business, not just to support our customer, but internally? And I think RevOps is well positioned to advise on that because they're the ones that really are understanding all of those connective processes, as well as like an understanding of the systems integration landscape, maybe better than anyone else if they don't, for example, have an enterprise systems team. And even if they have that, it's not just about the team, the systems and integration. It's about like, how are we actually optimizing how our teams work? And I think RevOps is constantly, if you have a strong RevOps team, really thinking about that.
Right, because there's the people factor too. So you're going between teams, different people that are, you know, handling different parts of the buying journey, and then the systems, and then the process. And you're right. I mean, that's my world. I'm constantly going back and forth between, you know, operations and, you know, all the different teams, even if they're not under my CRO. So that makes so much sense. And it's, you know, I think IT teams or enterprise systems teams, they're thinking about security and, you know, just kind of the basics, the bones of how things work, but not really the reality of the user experience, the internal user.
Yes. And they can be a bit disconnected from it, you know, just sometimes in the ways of organizational structure. Like I reported into a CIO org that was enterprise systems that luckily I was the head of BI in this team. I was BI and systems integration and kind of like emerged as RevOps before RevOps was a thing. But that was because I had a very growth minded CIO who said, no, we need to be very embedded in the business. But that's not always the case. Right.
Yeah, definitely. And then depending on what the C-suite looks like, what's your perspective in companies where, you know, there's a CMO and a CRO, right? So I've seen that in the world, or because you're mashing up these, you know, marketing ops, sales ops, customer success ops and everything. So what kinds of challenges have you seen there?
Oh gosh, where do we begin, Andy? Why don't I talk about one that went not well, and then one that went really well, or maybe not well, but like that was very challenging, right?
Yeah.
So I was in an organization, it was probably like about a series, was it a series C or D? Anyways, doesn't matter. 100 or 70 million maybe of funding, 250 people. I was reporting into the CRO. I was hired in to be the VP of Revenue Operations and Strategy, which in my interview process was, you will own sales ops and CS ops and marketing ops and enablement. And then I got in there the day of, do your homework in your interviews, make sure you're hearing all the same story. And they're like, actually, just kidding. Marketing ops is over here.
Yes.
And actually enablement's over here. And actually they're not reporting to you. Maybe we want that to happen. Why did this occur? The CRO had not talked to the CMO, had sold this vision. And then of course this blew up. So I think this is, you know, and that was a very painful experience because we were fractious as a result. There was opposition. It really illuminated the division between, in my mind, the CRO and the CMO. And so I'd seen this story before. I immediately within a week was like, oh, this is going to be a fun one. And I raised it to the CEO and I was like, we need to solve for this because if you really want my role to align the go-to-market, like I can do that, but we're going to go through a lot more pain if you don't hold these leaders accountable. And I don't care who I report to. Even if I report to the CRO, I still see my job is to represent the company. My job is to represent the go-to-market. That person is just there for like my performance reviews. And I mean, you might know this because we engage on LinkedIn. I'm not afraid to like say the thing. I mean, there are some leaders, and I've worked with some CMOs that say, well, Anne, if you report to the CRO, how do I know that you're going to represent this? How do I know that you're going to challenge the CRO? I'm like, well, you don't know me, but I will challenge, all of you will challenge the CEO. Right. That's not always the case though. So I understand that fear and that concern because it really depends on the leader. I'd been lucky though, now coming to what good looked like. So that one was just like a dumpster fire, right?
Right, right.
Spent like managing and, you know, negotiating back and forth between CMO and CRO because there was like a chasm. Mm-hmm. One of the other ones that was a much stronger story was in an organization where actually when I began, I was like VP of field operations. So I looked after sales ops, CS ops, and enablement, and marketing ops sat separately. And I was noticing that there was just a little bit more duplicity. I was noticing that we could have moved faster and more efficiently if we unified the functions, not because I needed to have a fempire, female empire, but just for like to support the business. But the business was not ready for that yet. You know, and the CMO, who is actually our chief commercial officer, who looked after marketing and product, was resistant because he's like, well, can I trust Anne? Is she going to represent my interests? Well, what ended up happening is I planted that seed. This was right when RevOps was becoming a thing. And I was like, this is the new way of work. This is what I think we need to do. Here's how I think it's going to benefit the business. And I presented it to the C-suites. They weren't ready for it yet. So I'm like, okay, we'll just wait. And as we waited, the pain started to build. And then COVID happened and there were layoffs. And as a result, we didn't have a VP of marketing anymore. And they were like, whoa, crud, what are we going to do with all these teams? Okay, now maybe is the time that we're going to unify it under Anne and make her, you know, overall RevOps. I actually called it BizOps because they also put product ops underneath there. Very quickly, we started to see the machine start to accelerate, right? And that was what the team members needed to see, the executive members needed to see. I then moved up and became an executive at this company to say, wait a minute, centralization when coordinated, and really we have one team that is beholden to across all of the pillars of go-to-market leadership is the way to go. And they were like, we're going to double down here. They moved sales development over there. They moved pre-sales. Anything that was kind of in between two teams or two different parts of the funnel, they were like, we need to nest within one org that's going to hold all of us accountable. And as a result of that, you know, literally within the quarter, 2 quarters following, from an SDR perspective, conversion perspective, we improved our conversion from SL through to SQL by 5 percentage points. From an overall net revenue retention target perspective, we were 250% to target. Was this the only thing that happened? No, there were many other optimizations, but this was a crucial choice that was made by the executive team, and then the results supported it.
Yeah, that's so important that, you know, I know everybody talks about alignment and everything, but having true alignment, it's challenging to do without the reporting structure to support it. So we can work together and collaborate. And that's, you know, when I talk to folks, you know, at conferences or on LinkedIn about, you know, how do I work with this person, or, you know, enablement's over here and I'm in RevOps, how do I get enablement to work with me, or how do I get marketing to work with me? And, you know, obviously there's a lot of people skills involved, required, but it makes it so much easier when, you know, it comes from the top and the reporting structure, you know, supports that, you know, more officially, because it just removes the friction, I think. And, you know, everybody is always going to be worried about their jobs, right? So if there is a marketing ops that is not, you know, in one place, then I think it's the challenge is just making sure you can partner together. Because there are things that are, you know, depending on your role in the organization, if I'm a new analyst or, you know, I'm aspiring RevOps leader, how do I help and make an impact and communicate and, you know, make some of those, build some of those bridges, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing, as you were speaking, Sandy, I was thinking back on that time, and it was, yes, we had to come at it from the top to have real alignment and like vision across the go-to-market. And that really needed to come from the CEO. Right.
Yeah.
But in addition, we also came from the bottom because, like, I don't want to take a team. They're like, oh, who's this person? Is she going to understand what we do? So there was also like a bottom grassroots advocacy that has to be done. And what I found, you know, I started in data analytics, in sales ops. Yes, I supported like marketing analytics in the past, but my roots were not in marketing ops. So what was really important to get closer to really get closer to what those teams were struggling with, what that they were doing, you know, I've mentored demand generation leaders. I've mentored marketing ops leaders, really understanding like the specifics of the work of what they do. So you can go down to a level of depth and build credibility and then accurately represent their pain, really key in building trust. The other thing that I'll add is I remember when this change happened, there was this just tireless, hardworking woman who was our marketing ops person. And she was working probably 80 to 90 hours a week. And nobody knew. And she was just like a workhorse and wouldn't complain. And I got in there and got closer to her. And I said, okay, let's talk about what you're doing. And then when I realized, wait, you can't be working with, like, you're going to burn out. This is not sustainable. Like, I have pushes where we got to work 60. I don't want that to be the norm. And so there was also suddenly, by bringing her into the fold of RevOps and then building out our roadmap of what are we doing, our weekly sprints of what's happening across the team, where are we prioritizing our time and integrating that, suddenly she had a conduit up to the top that was, what is this individual working on? How critical is that? What are things that could go to others in the revenue operations team to take off her plate so she is not so overburdened? And that really helped her just from like a longevity and being a staff member and impact that would not have happened had she not been part of a centralized team, as opposed to off here in a silo, nobody really knowing what she did. Even her old boss of VP of marketing was not involved. You just go and figure it out, and just kept piling on work to actually operating as a full team.
Right. And so not only is there the burnout factor in her potentially leaving, but you know, that could leave a huge hole in the organization as well, as she did, because then nobody knows what to do, right? That makes so much sense. And I like how you talked about, you know, understanding her pain. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a salesperson at heart. So I got my start in sales, like hustling Yellow Pages advertising, actually in your neck of the woods. And it was, you know, so you apply your internal selling skills, right? So I think being a RevOps leader, you have to be a salesperson, and you have to be a salesperson internally, understand their pains, understand what's happening, and really understand their process, I think, in building those relationships from the bottom. Because I think most of us need to do that, because not everybody's in the perfect world where the C-suite on day one is going to understand, like, you know, how important bringing systems together, or even things like, let's all get on one communication channel. Why is half of the organization using Slack and the other half of the organization using, you know, GChat? And, you know, I've been told on those things before, well, stay in your lane. That's not your lane. It's like, well, dude, it is kind of my lane, because if we're not communicating properly with other departments, then how are we able to support the, you know, all of those handoffs, and it just creates additional internal friction and all those things that come with it, all the downstream impacts.
Absolutely.
So are you, so when you think about, you know, marketing ops, sales ops, you know, CS ops, there's a lot of talk around, you know, go-to-market operations and this emerging. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to use the term crossover, but there is a lot, right? From, you think of revenue operations and go-to-market operations, and you know, obviously different companies that are product-led, you know, may have different needs. So what is your general thinking around the go-to-market operations function and, you know, that starting to really trend out there? I think that's going to be the next Forbes, you know, most posted position, like RevOps was, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I've had, when I think back on the roles and titles that I've had in this space, I've been in commercial operations, which was sales and marketing. And then our, you know, there was market research. I've been in business operations. Really, the reason they called it business operations was because I reported to the CFO. So they didn't want to call it revenue operations. But in that world, I ran go-to-market analytics. I ran sales ops, CS ops, marketing ops, enablement, pre-sales, sales development, product ops. Yep. They just didn't know what to call it. They're like, just call it this, right? Okay,
call fine. It something. Yep.
I have never had go-to-market ops, even though I think people, a lot of the times what I'm doing, refer to it as such. I actually don't really care what they call it. Part of why I think people are calling it something different is because, and I know it's more for when the leaders that I see using go-to-market operations are generally more senior in their tenure, more experience in terms of the number of times that they have been leading these types of functions, very, very cross-disciplinary. And they're trying to, I think, elevate and differentiate it from what RevOps has started to become, which is, you know, you can be part of a RevOps team. As we know, as you know, they're all the different functions. You could be a Salesforce architect who is part of RevOps. You could be maybe an SDR who, if sales development house, who is part of RevOps. You can be, you know, a marketing ops person that is part of RevOps, all of these things. And so I think people are trying to up-level it a little bit from it being adopted and becoming more mainstream to kind of differentiate themselves. So I think it actually, maybe it's a hot take. I think it has a little bit of selfish roots of like, that's not me. I'm different. I'm up here.
Right. Yeah.
Things. I mean, I'd be curious what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of from the same mindset. I think it really depends on the organization and maybe even the stage and what the focus is. You know, if you're constantly launching new products and, you know, and you have this, you know, really aggressive go-to-market, then it may warrant having something specifically focused on that. But I agree. I mean, generally speaking, I think outside of the strategy, so you start to potentially get into the, you know, the actual product strategy and, you know, how are you going to market? So I think that that may be the differentiating factor, but, you know, I agree. It's all a title. So, you know, that's why I tell people when they ask me, well, I'm interviewing for this job, you know, how should I prepare? And it's like, well, the title's one thing, but what does the job description say? Like, what are you actually owning in this job and managing or collaborating with, you know, what are the deliverables? Because even RevOps jobs, you know, probably half of them are sales ops, you know,
sales ops or systems. I see a lot of people who are systems people who are like, I'm a head of RevOps. I'm like, you've never run strategy. You never like,
right.
I would disagree. Right. Unless your RevOps team is focused purely on systems because you're in that infancy.
Right.
But I think your point around product strategy is a good one because, like I said, I've run product ops teams, but what goes into the launch of a product? I've run new packages. But then, like, are we going to just start to pull all of it? Is product marketing? At what point do we stop? Right. At what point do we stop implementing it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think at some point, you know, it's like people wanting to get more span of control. I mean, you have to know, like, you know, you're always dealing with a human at the other end of it and what they're, you know, everybody, you know, if you're working for another organization, you do have a job. So everybody, you know, at some level is worried about their own positions, even if they're not outwardly concerned about it or they're not operating that way. You know, people need to pay the bills and so I think there's some of that, but I'm not big on labels, you know, but it's definitely out there in the world and I see a lot of posts.
It is. And people are still trying to figure it out. And when people tell me, Ann, I'm a head of RevOps or Ann, we're hiring a head of RevOps. Can you help us with this search? I'm like, well, tell me what RevOps means to you and your organization. Tell me what the organizations are. Tell me what problems you're trying to solve. And that's going to help elucidate what they're really looking for. Maybe they don't actually need a head of RevOps. Maybe they just need a head of marketing ops, you know?
Right.
So I think getting into the specifics really, really key to kind of elucidate what the role is and what's required and what will go into that span of control, as you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another big piece of it when you're looking at RevOps is compensation. You know, how are you looking at, you know, sales compensation, commissions plans, you know, SDR compensation, you know, what do those plans look like?
Great point. And sometimes like I've nested that, I always have like, these are like, you know, my 7 or 8 pillars of what I've said is RevOps. And compensation planning is one of them. Sometimes people like to put that in, well, that's part of my strategy, right? But I'm like, no, it's compensation planning. But then, you know, there was just a conversation today in the Pavilion group that I'm in and somebody asked, hey, talk to us about what you think. There was a thread on like where commissions should sit. And I'm like, oh, interesting. Like how does this work with sales finance or finance and ops? And I just said, you know, here's what I've typically seen. It's very much shared. And when they were talking about commission, they meant overall comp planning and maybe commission administration. But that's something where like, I think parts of it do have to be shared. For governance.
Right.
Right. So like, I don't know about you, but like for me in roles where I've led RevOps, we owned comp plan design. By the way, finance does not want to own comp plan design. They're like, please.
No, they don't.
We are so far from that. We're like, we don't know what motivates them. I've had VPs of finance be like, why does it matter if we're paying on, you know, cash receipts, birth, book date? It's all the same. I'm like, not to the rep, not how you incent. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know? And so comp plan design, communication, stakeholder engagement around the design, rollout, tracking in terms of obviously attainment, all RevOps, and also approval cycles of the plan, signature, and then usually validation from finance saying, hey, we ran this report, this is what we're going to pay. Is this right? Mm-hmm. RevOps do that. But actually execution of that payment, calculations, finance, I don't want anything to do with that. I want them to, they're doing payroll. That's how people get paid. I shouldn't be touching that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Having the checks and balance. And I've come into two organizations in the past, and it was like the sales manager was putting everything in the spreadsheet, you know, self-approving and approving their own, you know, their own. I'm like, dude, like, you know, awkward. I don't know. This is a great thing, but yeah, having the governance on that is important, and finding the, you know, understanding the, I think only really RevOps or somebody that understands the sales cycle and what the salespeople are motivated by are going to be able to really build out those plans. But like we have a, you know, I constructed a plan when I came over to Patra, and we use a tool now because I did not want to deal with spreadsheets. That's the one thing I don't want to mess up. Yes. So that's the one thing I need to go get a tool for right away. And, you know, built out a multi-level approval system, some checks and balances. Yeah. And then it goes to finance and they cut the checks and they deal with all that. Those are important pieces. I think when you look at, you said you had 7 or 8 pillars. So your compensation planning, what were your other pillars of RevOps?
Oh gosh, let me see if I can recite them from scratch. So there's kind of like, there's like the strategy aspect. So, you know, this is where like all your planning will go into your setting of your go-to-market targets, your customer methodology. Notice that I said customer methodology. Mm-hmm. It's not just sales methodology. It's full funnel. It really needs to govern all of that. I mean, I remember when we rolled this out, someone from finance actually brought this up. They're like, we should be thinking about this methodology in terms of how we're writing our contracts as well. I'm like, wow, that person gets it. Yes. So you know, your TAM, SAM, your segmentation, I mean, operations broad, but I think of like core operations, like your operating cadence, your forecasting, your pipeline reviews, you know, your renewal forecasting, all those things kind of embedding. Enablement has been a really, really core pillar. And within enablement, it's not just training. I have used my heads of enablement as being like the core conduit of communication between the go-to-market teams. And I think that's like critical so that we have one single conduit. They're also responsible for knowledge management and also kind of like the cadence of like go-to-market briefings. How do we keep everybody aware of what's happening from like what we've developed from a product perspective, how that translates through the messaging, thank you, product marketing, and then how we enable the teams and kind of going back and forth. So enablement's a pillar. We've discussed compensation planning. Again, if you have sales development or business development as part of RevOps, that can be its own pillar as well. So that can sit there. And I'm also one pillar, I mean, I don't want to call it PMO because then people get antsy, like why is PMO and RevOps? But I am a deep believer that RevOps, go-to-market ops, whatever you want to call it, a key differentiator for what a strong practitioner looks like, has a very strong project management mindset. Mm-hmm. You know, really thinking through how do I launch initiatives? How do I get them over the line? I think you were maybe asking me in like the prep, what's a mantra that you said, RevOps mantra? Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've told my team is, you don't get a prize for getting to the 3-yard line. You got to get over that line, right? Yeah. So many times, like you do all this work and then it just drops and you forget about because you get busy. Mm-hmm. We complete and we deliver, right? And so get over the 3-yard line, get over the finish line. If you're a sports fan, get the touchdown, whatever. I think that's really key. And so much of that comes back to project management, but also within that stakeholder management, keeping everybody on the same page. And then the last pillar is really like really your data and analytics. And that can be anything, data and analytics. Systems could go there. Sometimes it's separate. It really depends. Your systems architecture. Obviously, like I think that having a very, very strong go-to-market systems foundation, especially in the day that we're an age that we're in, such a differentiator. How many times have I gone in and they're like, oh, we turn somebody into an admin. And they're a Salesforce admin who just like builds and builds and builds and builds, but doesn't think about architecture, has no idea how to engage stakeholders, doesn't think about UX. That's going to create a lot of pain for your organization.
That is such a huge point, because that's how you get all the duct tape and band-aids, right? Because admins, phenomenal, but sometimes if you're not thinking about the bigger picture, you know, the role that I have and had in my prior org, hired for is a head of rev tech architect, essentially. So it's, you know, if whether you're a Salesforce, HubSpot, or whatever shop, that's their core foundation, but they need to have the ability to understand how all the integrations work, you know, you don't want to get, you know, loops and, you know, duplicate information and things breaking. So you want somebody to be thinking strategically about how to set up the technology and how to, you know, in a lot of cases, reduce the technology and make it work and get rid of those Frankenstacks, you know, that are out there.
So many. We've all been there, right? Like the number of times, Sandy, I've gone into an organization, and yes, I've come from more, I was part of enterprise systems. You know, I was with Medallia when we went from 100 to 350 million, they IPO'd. We had like several hundred applications. And I remember seeing that systems architecture landscape map. It was heavy. Mm-hmm. But when I go into an organization, that's not even, you know, seed or A. I mean, these are BC organizations. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, hey, where's your go-to-market systems landscape roadmap? And they go, oh, we have a list of 5 apps that we use. I'm like, no, that's not what I'm asking for. I'm like, great. But there's a lot more apps. Or they're like, okay, fine. You don't have a systems architecture landscape map. You don't understand the flows. Fine. We can work on that. Has anybody done an audit of the systems? Oh yeah, it lives in like these 8. Well, marketing has one and sales has one and CS has one. So literally I'll go and I'll be like, we're having one go-to-market systems audit. And I collaborate work with all the functional teams, even if they don't report into me at first, like that one where they're like, marketing ops actually sits over here. And then we look for the duplicity, and we look for, why do we still have this? Maybe the person who we didn't even know we had it. This is why companies like Anthropic and Productive exist. Right? We're going to unearth all this like shadow IT tech. It's not to necessarily control all of it, but sometimes you don't know. Then you're like, I can't hire a RevOps analyst, but you're paying for all this tech that if you just got rid of like 3 things that no one's using, it would probably fund that analyst salary. Yeah. Right. And so it's such like a low hanging fruit, and nobody was accountable to doing it in a centralized way because they didn't have a head of RevOps.
Yep. Yeah. And it gets out of control so quickly from, you know, series A to B to C. You have head of marketing. Well, I'm going to grab this tool, and then it's a free, then it becomes a team. Then soon it becomes an enterprise. And now you're stuck with that one. And then they hired a head of sales and they got this tool and they're not. So it happens. I've seen it happen so quickly. But I think anybody, no matter what level you are, if you approach it, you know, in the right way, can ask those questions. And what is all the tech, you know, that we have, and, you know, in a professional way, show where you can save money. You know, this is an exercise that I did in a prior org, and it turned out the head of IT had no idea. We had 2 instances of Monday, and we had Road Monk, and we had Smartsheet. So we basically had 4 contracts that we were paying for 4 different project management tools. And so it was really easy to say, like, here's $100,000 right here. And we, you know, I worked with all the teams and we consolidated, you know, to one platform. It was a little painful because we had to, you know, get alignment on which one and those things. But, you know, nobody could justify that it made any sort of logical sense to have, you know, and then even 2, like somebody had one on their like corporate credit card,
yeah, the corporate credit card
edition, and then someone had a,
and it just happens, right? It's not like no one was doing something; they were doing things that probably made sense at the time. They didn't have a procurement function.
Right.
They didn't have this. You know, I remember I joined one organization, and my manager of enablement said, "I'm like, oh well." They asked. They're like, "Oh, and this renewal of X technology is coming up." I'm like, "Okay, well, who's the signatory authority?" And they said, what? I'm like, you know, the person who signed it. They're like, oh, that was me. I was like, I'm pretty sure you don't have, how much is this renewal for? And it was like, for over $10,000. I'm like, we have an updated policy but it hadn't sold back. And she's like, oh, I could just sign it. I'm like, no, 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 you cannot sign that. Nope. I can't even sign it. This has to go up. But it's okay. She wasn't doing anything wrong. That didn't exist when they procured this. And then the company just grew and accelerated so much. And then we were just trying to catch up. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how those challenges, and then down the road, they create friction in, you know, handoff processes. And those are one of my, the things that frustrates me a lot is, you know, having these handoffs between systems and people and process. And I think that's where revenue operations should really focus. And I really hate the term handoff. It's like, I'd love to just call it, you know, anything else but handoff, like make something up, because to me, it feels like, you know, if you're the customer, you know, here, we're going to pass the baton and then, you know, we're done. And then, you know, they feel that. So I don't know if you've had experience, you know, cleaning up any handoff process between marketing and sales, or sales to, you know, project management or implementation or customer success. Do you have anything that comes to mind?
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, I think you talk about kind of the experience it creates from a customer perspective of that, mm-hmm. the handoff, right? But I think it happens internally as well. Well, I did my job. It's marketing's job now. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not mine. And so I want to come back to something a little bit philosophical that I like deeply mm-hmm. believe in. And so whenever I have a robots team or any team that I join, I kind of establish like a credo, like a handbook by which we're going to operate. And within that, usually it is aligned to the values of the company. I don't want to be like rogue and have my own values, but there are specific values that I really, really associate with high-performing revenue teams, and in particular, high-performing centralized operations, go-to-market operations, revenue operations team. And one of the top factors in that is accountability. And when I talk about accountability, mm-hmm. I'm like, this is a non-negotiable. Like, I expect this from every single person in my team. What I tell them is, you know, accountability is, yes, you take accountability for what you were going to do, but we're going to go a step deeper. I expect you, as part of your accountability, to know what comes before and after you're going to do. And so you're greasing the skids in both directions. And when you do that, and then this supports one of the other tenets, which is like, really, we operate as one team. It comes back to that woman I was telling you in marketing ops, who was like so overloaded doing 90 hours a week. I exposed that in our sprint plan. And I was like, we're taking these off of so-and-so's plate. We're moving them over. You have the capability. No one on our, or we're going to not do these things because we're just not going to do them anymore.
Right.
My decision. And then the things we have to do, we're going to reload this so that we can operate as one team. I've told my team members, I'm like, do not ever come to me and never let me. There are certain things that like, I'm like, you know, you want to work whatever hours you need to work, as long as you get your job done. You want to like take your kid to the doctor. Don't ever ask me that. Just take your kid to the doctor.
Yeah, just do it.
You know, and the thing that I, as a non-negotiable, is do not ever say, that's not my job. Do not ever say, well, I pass it up to them and I don't know. I expect you to know. I expect you to know. And that is part of partnership. And then as a result of that, like mindset around accountability, I think for internally, it really helps. It doesn't feel like a handoff because it's a shared, like, it's a shared ownership, right? Mm-hmm. With respect to customer, I mean, the traditional handoffs that you would see, you know, marketing funnel to sales funnel, how we're really managing that experience from a team perspective, you know, if you have SDRs picking up the lead, really making sure we're being very tight. Everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing and what happens when they pass the AE, setting very, very clear standards of what is expected of both, if you have an SDR, what is expected of the seller, and holding both accountable. For example, mm-hmm. if the SDR does everything according to the qualification methodology that we have established, and that AE does not accept, I'm not going to talk to the SDR, I'm talking to the AE, right? So we hold them accountable to that. Sales to CS, things that we've implemented in past is, okay, we needed to make sure that we had a really, really strong handoff supporting customer experience. Mm-hmm. How do we get ahead of that, but not do too much work too early? Well, the moment that it hits a certain stage, boom, we send a notification to the CS team, head of CS, it's time to assign a CS leader or a CSM mm-hmm. to this account. It's time to, you know, trigger notification. This is in a late stage, start to organize a kickoff. Both people are held accountable to attending, both AE and CSM, have a prep call in advance. And a lot of this can be facilitated through automation. And the result of that mm-hmm. is a very seamless customer experience where the customer is not having to come in and catch the seller and the CSM up on what's happening. They've already done that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so critical. And doing it really well too can, it can really help even close a deal, mm-hmm. right? On some of these enterprise deals where you're bringing in CS in that late stage and scheduling the kickoff call and making the introduction.
100%.
And I mean, those are just, it's so huge.
And I'm going to come back to this. I'll speak from my own experience as, you know, you're a head of RevOps. You've bought, I imagine, and churned a lot of technology, mm-hmm. as have I. And I will share that as a result of an experience I had as a customer, as the economic buyer with a tool, with the CS team, it was the strongest launch onboarding and value planning exercise I had ever had as a buyer. I was so impressed by them. I referred them to multiple people. I let them, because they didn't have a Salesforce architect, I let them leverage some of our research to shape product. I then even went and joined that company later when mm-hmm. I left. So it, wow. it like paid dividends in terms of how they architected this really, really top-notch customer experience and handoff.
Yeah, that's so important for that longevity and for, you know, just really for everything and having it. Customers should never feel like they're experiencing a different process when it goes from sold to, you know, now they're implementing and they're becoming a customer.
Oh, yeah.
They shouldn't feel any different.
And you know, it's happened. I mean, it's happened for companies with a lot of resources. One that will not be named, mm-hmm. but it might have gone viral in a post that I did last year. I mean, I had probably 4 different meetings before, this was 2 or 3 companies ago, because we were unhappy with the experience. And I provided the feedback. They're like, we want to have a meeting with you. And we've invited X executive and they're going to come and have a conversation. And then they came in and nobody had briefed them. And then I was like really annoyed as the customer. Mm. Can you all do your homework before you set an hour with me to talk about how you're going to turn this around so we can actually turn it around? We will do better. And the next one, they did it again. They did it again.
Wow.
I was so done. And for that, I just churned it. Like, it was so bad. Yeah. And all it took was them talking to one another. And so,
or listen to a recording, you know, like, just like, even if you can't talk to them, listen to the last recording. Hopefully it's there, right?
This is almost where I feel like in that case, they had so many cooks in the kitchen. Mm. Nobody knew who was accountable, right?
Yeah.
And so like, they just kept bringing somebody in and repeating the same mistake. And it's mm-hmm. an inexcusable. And this is like over $1 billion company, public company, completely inexcusable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where the mapping out the customer journey and who is the, you know, back to a racy jar, who is accountable for the customer at all times and who owns the relationship. So you have different roles. We've called it a deal team. So, you know, who's on first on the deal team and who is the person who's accountable for scheduling the kickoff and those briefings. And I think that goes back to, you know, core fundamentals of being a RevOps leader is mapping out the customer journey from a process perspective first and getting all those stakeholders, whether or not they roll up in your organization, doesn't matter, you know, running around to every stakeholder, you know, okay, what do you do here? What should you do? And getting alignment on that is critical, because then it's like, well, I don't know, you know, she's supposed to do this, he's supposed to do that.
And, it's the most critical, you know, fundamental exercise I do in every org, even if it exists. Has it ever been connected? Is it old? Is it mm-hmm. out of date? Do people know about it? Has it been socialized? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, even I'm like, oh, you have a sales process? Okay. Do they know about it? Has the customer team seen it? Have they given input? So I'll usually be like, we're going to do a refresh of it. And then I've gone into orgs where I'm like, what about post-sale? And they're like, what do you mean post-sale? I'm like, well, where's the process? They're like, they don't have one. They have renewal comes up 3 months before we reach out to them. I'm like, you're hosed. No wonder your TRR is out.
Yeah, you're done.
Right?
So, yeah. That's crazy. That's crazy. So you mentioned enablement a couple times. I wanted to just drill down on that just for a minute before we wrap up is, you know, you mentioned enablement as one of your mm-hmm. pillars. And I think in your world, enablement is part of revenue operations. So what is your, you know, opinion on that? Because I think a lot of companies have, you know, enablement in different mm-hmm. areas and, you know, there's a lot, I mean, a lot of enablement groups as well.
Yes.
So, you know, what are your thoughts in general around enablement?
Yeah. And here's the thing. I've had Enablement be a part of my org multiple times, mm-hmm. and I've had it be a partner org where it fed into mm-hmm. a VP and we partnered very closely. And I think it can make sense, again, based on where you're at in your go-to-market journey and your yeah. maturity curve, right? If you get to a point where Enablement isn't just, you know, typically starts as sales Enablement, and we're like, oh, we need mm-hmm. customers and CS Enablement. I personally think it should be go-to-market Enablement, where you are responsible mm-hmm. for streamlined comms across centralized management. You know, when I was in an organization, just documentation sat everywhere. It was in a G drive. It was completely disorganized. And I remember originally people like, we need to just organize the G drive. And I'm like, what's going to be the face for the G drive? How are we going to people know, like, where's like the map? And so what we ended up doing is, and we just did this like ourselves. So we organized the G drive, but the person who was responsible for organizing the G drive of all the curated content, teams could have their own folders. I wasn't going to manage their team folders. But curated specific knowledge that everybody needed to make sure was the latest and greatest was managed via Enablement. They were the only ones who could touch and move things into folders. The map in terms of like, you know, hierarchy of knowledge all sat on one Notion page. And then we had a Slack group called like the hub. We called this all the hub. And everybody mm-hmm. knew that if you had a question about go-to-market, if you needed training, you went to the hub. First, you went and you looked in the hub navigation to see if it was there. And then if it didn't exist, then you could ask a question, you could submit a ticket. So by doing this, the knowledge one absorption just was so much stronger. People knew they were working the latest and greatest. They didn't have some old pitch deck that hadn't improved, et cetera. That was really, really key. I think though, when you get beyond sales and CS and suddenly you have like partner teams, right? Mm-hmm. Customer Enablement. Now it's becoming a really big function. And I'm normally reaches that size. I'm like, I mean, I could do it if you like I can manage that, but you're going to need an actual head. Am I a head of Enablement? Yeah. Have I ever run Enablement org? Is that my expertise area? No, it's not. Do I know fantastic Enablement leaders I would absolutely bring in
right.
and coach them up to a point? And then maybe they get to a stage where we're peers because they have so much, like you said, span of control, it needs to split mm-hmm. off. Great. But then we're very much tied at the hip, you know?
Yeah.
And so again, like, I think though that Enablement is such a critical function, and why I like it initially in RevOps is I'm like, well, we're building out the strategy, and then we're building out the process to support the strategy. We're building out, you know, the technology as a foundational element as well. And then we're running the business. But oftentimes when I think about this whole flow, Enablement is like, do people know about it? And are they providing feedback to it? And are we iterating? And is our voice on the ground and ears on the ground? Because sometimes the people that are doing the operating and doing the process, doing the system are not getting that feedback. So I rely on Enablement. It's not that these people cannot, but to really be the voice of the go-to-market team, helping shape that. So we're always thinking the mind of our internal customer.
That makes sense. And it's really a mindset Enablement. So wherever it sits, I think RevOps needs to have that mindset is how, because ultimately all of the folks that are going to use the materials, whether it's marketing, sales, you know, a project management team or customer success, they need to be able to find it. They need to have it at their fingertips. It needs to be consumable, shareable. You know, they need to be trained on it, you know, all these things. So I think I like how you use the term partnership. Wherever it sits, I think it's the responsibility of both of those leaders to make sure it is a partnership, you know, particularly when it comes to, you know, all of the materials and tech and rolling things out. You know, it has to be a joint process.
Absolutely. And I'll bring up one more, you know, product marketing at Enablement, probably one of the strongest partnerships that exists, right? And mm-hmm. I mean, I've worked with many CMOs and product marketing leaders, and they're just like generating so much content, battle cards, this new pitch decks, you know, but what they often need is, well, what's coming from sales or what's mm-hmm. coming from our customers and what are you hearing? And they just can't like develop all this stuff and be there. Maybe they're watching Gong calls. And so Enablement is bringing that. They're like, well, I'm sitting on the forecast calls and I'm listening to these and I'm pulling and I'm curating and consolidating all of that. And then I'm getting that over to you. And then they're developing the content. And then the head of Enablement is like, okay, hopefully has, I like hiring former sellers to be a head mm-hmm. of Enablement or former our customer success professionals, because they think in the mind of those individuals, what's going to work, what are their objections going to be, and so they can bake that into, now I have this great piece of content, how am I going to deliver that and get people to actually use it? And so that relationship so key. And when we've had that, really, again, Racy very clearly defined, what does product marketing do, what does enablement do, the efficiency with us to be able to like distribute, create new content, distribute it, get it using, get feedback so much faster.
Yeah. Yeah. That feedback is so important. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm sure we could go on for probably another hour. But I would love for you to leave our listeners, you know, particularly people that are, you know, looking to develop their career in revenue operations, you know, maybe some tips, words of wisdom, you know, before we sign off.
Sure. And also, Sandy, thank you so much for having me. I really look forward to the day when we can meet at one of these conferences.
In person, yes.
Have a hang. I think you're a big workout person as well, so we can do a workout. Tips. Okay, firstly, if you're looking for like, where do I go and find out? Well, come and join RevOps Village, the community that I run. Google group it. It's free. Anyone can join. It's not just for RevOps. I also have revenue professionals, sellers. Again, I'm a believer that like, if sellers come and learn how to better sell to RevOps, it's a win-win, right? Yeah. So if you're in the revenue world or aspiring to, you can join. We do monthly webinars. That's one thing. A tip that I'm going to share, and I actually shared this with a revenue operations leader recently, in terms of, okay, if you want to kind of grow in your career and get up to like rise in the ranks, like, do I have to like be experts in all of these disciplines? No, you don't. I think pick within the pillars of RevOps, I named several of them, pick like two that you're really, really good at and know them so deeply that you can go all the way on the ground. So the people on the ground doing it, you can be at that level with them in the trench. And then you can pull up and anchor in those and then continue to build. So mine are like analytics is like a core of mine. I started in analytics. That's like the thread all the way through. Mm-hmm. And then I think like true, like understanding like operating cadence and cross-functional operating and getting teams to really align around that, it would be another one. So know those, invest deeply there. Maybe you're like, I really love systems and I want to learn that. And maybe you're like, what's a good complement to that? I would say, analytics. How are people using those systems to make data-informed decisions? Or maybe you go to the complete opposite way. A lot of people that are really, really strong in systems, I'm not going to make a generalization, but maybe I will, sometimes struggle to think in the mind of the customer. Maybe you need to take a UX class or like go spend time with your sales team. So have two and really go deeply there because I think like I see some leaders who get up here and can be all strategy. And when you come into a RevOps org as a new leader, usually it's a dumpster house on fire, right? And process, as you know, like build process. You also have to get this team to trust you and want to work with you. And the way that I have done that is being able to meet them where they are in the trench and show them like, hey, I know that, or I know a couple of these. And then for the areas that I don't know, I'm going to be like, that's why you're here. So you can teach me. Right. And so those would be a couple tips I would say.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're going into a Series A or Series B, you're going to be a one woman operation in there. So you've got to be able to dig in and get it done and build the process, build the system and all the other things as you build out your organization. So that's great advice, great tips. And I just really appreciate you coming on the show and chit-chatting. And I'm sure we will chit-chat more, but thanks for joining today, Anne. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Sandy. Bye now.
All right. Okay, everyone. This has been another episode of RevOps Unboxed. Thank you for listening. This has been another episode of RevOps Unboxed in partnership with the Revenue Operations Alliance. Until next time, keep unboxing.